You've heard of Grammarly, and you might think it's a fancy spell check, but people on your team have been using it and loving it for years, because it does way more than you realise. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that works seamlessly across apps and websites and can write an instant first draft in a few clicks, not a few hours. When every word your team writes is clear, concise, and on brand, companies can save 19 days per employee per year. Learn what better writing can do for your company at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
I'm Caroline Hyde at Bloomberg's World Headquarters in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco. This is Bloomberg Technology.
And boy, do we have a lot to digest today, particularly on the Disney front. It is front and center as company cuts 7,000 jobs and Disney Plus subscribers actually drop. We bring you full coverage throughout the hour.
And Google shares tumbling by the most since October as doubts rise over the accuracy of the search giant's AI technology. We'll bring you the details.
Plus, Hermes wins out versus Meta Birkins. We'll discuss the first ever trademark trial examining NFTs as the case tests the line between art and consumer products. All that and so much more coming up.
One name that everyone wants to hear about is Disney. Shares really accelerating their gains in after hours, not necessarily on the beat on the bottom line, but on what they had to say about going forward, targeting $5.5 billion in cost reductions, cutting around 7,000 jobs, but reiterating that profit guidance for the direct-to-consumer or streaming business in 2024. Those are kind of the main takeaways as the stock push higher. Let's go deeper on Disney, get reaction with Ross Gerber, co-founder and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth Management, which oversees $2.2 billion and holds Disney shares. Ross, what was the most important bit for you? What is it that you think's driving these shares higher in after hours?
Well, I think that they show that their business is not only stable, but has the potential for a lot of growth, actually. So when you actually look at the sub losses, let's say at Disney Plus, it was really at Hotstar and in the Indian part of their business, Hotstar. And it was really a minimal amount of people and the lowest cost subscribers. So when you actually look at Disney Plus and their ability to hopefully make money off of this in the future, and then the cost cuts, but then how strong the parks and resorts business continues to be, and with Iger back at the helm, it really gives confidence that they can get the rest of their businesses all working together at some point in the next 12 months and really get some earnings momentum back. So I love the report, what I've seen so far, and I'm very confident about Disney's future.
EPS beat in the fiscal fourth quarter and then reiterating that guidance to hit profit in the D2C business by 2024. How much of for you is that Iger doing this, the sort of short-term effect of him coming back in?
Well, I think there's a psychological effect, and then there's a real effect, because the bottom line is Chapek was a bad manager for Disney and didn't do a good job. And with Iger back at the helm, Disney's really driven by content. And it's something I think a lot of people forget, that making great movies is what ultimately drives everything at Disney, whether it's consumer products or the parks or Disney Plus. And so Iger's focus on content and his relationships in Hollywood to get better content and to make better content really bodes well for Disney over the short and medium term.
Longer term, can they square that circle of cost cuts and great production? How has the restructuring of the business and perhaps giving more power back to the creatives going to ensure they can have that balance?
Well, I think this is, a lot of businesses are dealing with this, where they grew a lot of people over the last 3 or 4 years, and now everybody's trying to right-size their business, especially the mega cap stocks like Disney. And so I think having you're going to see this in a lot of companies, right? Real cost conscious focus and making sure that all of their employees are contributing the amount necessary to get the results needed from a financial perspective is really important. But it's also predicated upon not hurting your own core business. And I think Iger is the person to implement that strategy for Disney. And that's why I think the markets like it.
Yeah, currently looking at new Toy Stories, new Frozens. My children will be thrilled. I'm looking also at what Bob Iger has been saying on the call. Just take a little listen to what he's saying in terms of curation.
We will aggressively curate our general entertainment content. We will reassess all markets we have launched in and also determine the right balance between global and local content. We'll adjust our pricing strategy, including a full examination of our promotional strategies.
Russ, you reminded us of how big Disney Plus or generally D2C is in India. Just how much of a focus does Disney need internationally at the moment? Because we can get very myopic about what's happening here in the United States.
Yeah, so it's really interesting because, you know, Netflix, for example, is a global business, and you look at the content today and you're getting content from like all over the place, and a lot of it's really good. And they've been doing really well with subtitles. And I think Disney needs to do the same thing. And especially India is a huge market for Disney Plus Hotstar. And it's a very, you know, deep movie-focused consumer there. So, you know, we've got to make content that really serves the different audiences that are paying for Disney. But we also have to do it in a way that makes economic sense as well. And I think that is a real challenge that streamers face on an international level. But for Disney's core movie and production, most people around the world like that content, Americans and everyone else. So Disney has a great position to leverage their content in every market.
Russ, will this news placate Peltz? Will he step back a bit from what he's trying to do?
Well, I think Peltz is misguided, and I wish him well, but he's attacking the wrong people, and he's wrong about his basic premise of he says Disney's in crisis, and I'm like, what are you talking about? Disney's about to take off. I don't think he has the skill sets that he would add anything to the Disney board, and I think he's going to make money anyways owning Disney, and we're long Disney in my fund, GK, as well as at my firm, and it's a top holding. But having Iger back and the team that they have at Disney, this is the ideal situation. And I don't think breaking up the business like spinning off ESPN makes any sense. I love the sports business. So, you know, I think Iger is the right person to do this, and Peltz is barking up the wrong tree.
We wait for that share price recovery to follow suit then. Still 44% off its highs, but there's an optimistic Ross Gerber there. We thank you, co-founder and CEO of Gerber Kawasaki Wealth and Investment Management. Meanwhile, let's talk about the competitor Netflix, because today it said it's rolling out its paid sharing feature to four new markets. Now, the streaming service is announcing that Canada, New Zealand, Portugal and Spain can now add an extra member account for up to two people that they don't live with at a cost, though. And that's, of course, as it looks to stamp out password sharing outside of the household. Netflix has not yet rolled out paid sharing here in the United States, but is expected to do so by the end of the first quarter, Ed.
Yeah, I think that's a really specific micro look. Let's get back, though, and talk a bit more macro. As Carrie said earlier in the show, when it comes to tech, you know, a down day, but we're giving back what's been a pretty long run of gains. So let's look at the historic performance and bring in Fidelity Director of Quantitative Market Strategy, Denise Chisholm, who's been tracking this historical database going back to the 1960s. Her research informs the firm's strategy across its portfolios. And of course, Fidelity Asset has more than $3.6 trillion in assets under management. It's really interesting, Denise, to kind of sit here with Caroline. Each day we go through the blow by blow of the markets, what's driving the narrative on any given day. But even if you go back to just the start of the year, we've gone from this position of kind of worst to first for the technology sector, yet some of the fundamentals don't really back that up.
Yeah, well, that often happens, especially you can see it through history where stocks follow earnings a lot of the time, but not all of the time. And a lot of cyclical sectors can discount bad news in advance. And I think that this is what you're starting to see in technology. Now, what we saw last year of essentially downside leadership was really not just the rationale behind the fact that interest rates went up, inflation went up, a more hawkish Federal Reserve. It was also your starting point on relative valuation. So versus the overall market, technology was really in the top quartile of its history since, and we haven't seen anything like that back till 2005.
Yeah.
And that was really one of the key, you know, down to the key catalysts for the correction that we've seen last year. A lot of that valuation on a relative basis has been worked off. And we're left in this sort of muddy middle zone where technology is not the dominant sector that we've seen over the last decade, which were very supportive on relative free cash flow, but it's also not in that very, very expensive land versus the market either.
Okay, so when it is relative, where then gives up? Do we need to see the rest of the market? And by that, we mean basically not the growth stocks, but more of your energy names and more of your tried and trusted value companies to get a higher valuation? Or do we need more pain to come in technology valuations?
I think that there's a lot of different ways that you can work it off. You could also have a positive catalyst, meaning that the downside in margins is less than investors actually expect. And one of the catalysts historically is something that investors might be missing out on now, which is disinflation. When inflation decelerates, what you usually have is margins better than expectations. This is true in the overall market. This is also true in technology. That's one of the reasons why you hear people say in a high inflationary environment, usually earnings recessions are less bad. It's not necessarily that inflation is good for margins, but it's because inflation is high and can decelerate that can provide a tailwind to margins that isn't typical in the rest of history.
Let's just talk. It's interesting. We've been talking to those that manage certain stock exchanges, and we understand that perhaps not many IPOs are going to be coming thick and fast or exits in the world of technology, but maybe performance is there from some of these key companies. And we spoke to Adina Friedman, of course, and just take a listen to what she had said about her optimism.
I think that the big technology companies have huge opportunities in front of them. I think that they're leaning in as hard as they can. I think that they also are bringing the entire economy forward. So I'm a big believer in tech and big tech.
So clearly, well, I'm sure it's a job, which is overseeing the NASDAQ, to be a big believer in big tech. But ultimately, Denise, what about, is it international big tech that you want to see outperform? Or do we think you can be domestically focused? I'm interested on what you think as to whether dollar's going to be a driver or not going forward.
I do think that you want to be domestically focused, and it's in part because of the dollar, but it's in part because, as you know, we just heard, they're better companies. When I hear a lot of comparisons going back to the dot-com era, what's really important for investors to understand is during that time, before the recession even hit, net margins were negative. So not only are net margins positive even after the contraction, but they're still at the highest levels they've been since the 1960s in my data set. So these are much, much better companies. And that secular trend is dominant in the U.S. So each cycle, they've made more and more profit free cash flow. And I expect that that trend will likely continue.
Fidelity Director of Quantitative Market Strategy, Denise Chisholm, a data cruncher, chart watcher. Thank you for going with my chart. If you didn't like it, I was going to blame John Authors, our markets editor, who I borrowed it from, but I think it was a hit. So we'll have you back on. Thank you very much for your time. Now, coming up, Google's AI ambitions facing hurdles as concerns rise over its accuracy. We'll bring you the details next. And another stock we're watching, Caro, as we head to break, Robinhood shares, interesting, fourth quarter net sales missing, some interesting financials, and yet here we are, 5% higher in after hours.
The big takeaway for me has got to be how the co-founders are cancelling, what, half a billion each of their share-based compensation. So clearly feeling that they have to pull back in terms of their own wins through this stock at the moment, as they are still trying to right-size this business. Overall, still losing a little bit in terms of a net loss, 166 million. We keep an eye on all of these movers for you, Ed. From New York, from San Francisco, this is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks, like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly. Easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It's early days, but Google's Bard has already hit a snag. Shares of parent Alphabet sank Wednesday after reports that a video posted 2 days earlier demonstrating Bard's AI-powered search had an inaccuracy. In the clip posted by Google, Bard is asked, "What new discoveries from the James Webb Space Telescope can I tell my 9-year-old about?" In response, it says, "JWST took the very first pictures of a planet outside of our own solar system." But that's not true. The first pic taken of a planet outside of our solar system was taken by the Very Large Telescope Array in Chile in 2004. Webb was deployed at the end of 2021. It is a setback for Google's challenge to Microsoft's work with OpenAI, using the tech behind ChatGPT to improve Bing. Google told me in a statement, "This highlights the importance of rigorous testing, which it will start this week. It'll also take on external feedback."
I mean, the external feedback I was talking about was probably the market reaction, right? Shares falling by the most since October. But there's kind of two key things. Like, this video came out on Monday, and it took 2 days for journalists and the market to notice. But also, I mean, Alphabet and Google have always said this is experimental right now, but the market's impatient.
They're impatient. And it's funny that they let OpenAI own the fact that we're likely to see a lot of problems and inaccuracies. Yeah. But Google always has, well, they're a victim of its own success. It's the big brand. It doesn't want to front run and go too quickly. It's interesting when we asked our own audience, Ed, when will generative AI be fully accurate? I thought most would actually say 3 to 6 months, because there's my own impatience. But actually, most people are more sensible and they say, look, give it 5 to 10 years. We've got to let them chew the data and get the accuracies out there.
It's well, let's just get more details and bring in Bloomberg's Davey Alba, because I've been working with Davey on this all day long. Davey, we went over the basics of the story around the answer around the telescope, but I guess let's start with, what does this mean right now for Alphabet and Google? What's their response been to what's been a pretty nuts market day and some skepticism around Bard?
Yeah, I mean, I think Google's response has been, look, this is still in sort of testing mode. Right now, it's only open to a few trusted testers that have access with the company. And it's still ironing out the kinks. You know, we've done some reporting that this is just not something that seems ready for prime time quite yet, which is why they're keeping it sort of under wraps to the wider public, at least for now.
And sort of the irony in all of this is the reason perhaps OpenAI stole the oxygen in November and ran and able to sort of leave what it felt like Google for dust for a bit was because Google realized the PR headache it might have if it put something into the open, and it got it a bit wrong. The brand impact is far bigger. But now, do you think that the code red that they pulled is going to have to be still pulled? Are they going to have to keep iterating in public?
Yeah, I think to some extent, the market pressures are something that they can't ignore anymore at this point. You know, there's a huge threat from OpenAI. And, you know, in the last day, we found that it's not just, you know, sort of the ChatGPT, but they're integrating, Microsoft is integrating a cousin of ChatGPT into its search as well. So Microsoft Bing, yes, and its Edge browser. And so this is already hitting at Google's core business search, and they have to respond. So this is what they're doing.
The timing of this, Dave, is strange. Partly because this video was published 2 days ago, right? But there was also this big event in Paris today. What did we actually learn about the strategy from Google around AI from that event?
It seems like Google is being very careful about rolling this out. So the event sort of gave a little bit more by way of demonstrations and examples of Bard. You know, we saw it sort of showing what constellations you can look for in the sky, for instance, or just like advice on very low stakes situations. So right now, Bard is in a place where it can't give something like medical or legal advice responsibly. And Google is really sort of clamping down, yeah, on the examples that it is willing to show publicly. I think, you know, the key point for people to understand is that these large language models, they're not really good for consistently true statements. Yeah. They only spit out statistically consistent statements. So phrases that appear together. And so that's kind of where we're at right now.
Davey, you broke it down beautifully. Thank you, Davey Alba. Hermes has won a lawsuit it filed against the digital artist behind Meta Birkin NFTs. That's after convincing a Manhattan federal jury that the sale of the non-fungible tokens violated Hermes's rights to the Birkin trademark. Now, the announcement could be a bit of a setback for the NFT industry as the case tested the blurry line between art and consumer products. And ultimately, Ed, this is all about a company trying to understand really who wins out, digital artistry and the First Amendment. Not so Hermes manages to win out in this case. Welcome back to Bloomberg Technology. I'm Caroline Hyde in New York.
And I'm Ed Ludlow in San Francisco.
And Ed, Uber shares today, up as much as 7% earlier after reporting revenue climbing 49%. Now that beat analyst estimates. How has Uber been able to defy inflation fears? Well, the CEO, Dara Khosrowshahi, talked all about it with Bloomberg earlier.
Well, for us, what we're seeing is while there has been a downturn in terms of companies being more conservative in terms of their spend, the consumer is staying strong. Consumers' spend continues to be strong. And also, we're benefiting from a shift of consumer spend from retail, buying stuff when you're home, to actually spend on services, going out to restaurants, traveling, et cetera. So Uber is absolutely benefiting from that. And that's why you've seen gross bookings growth of 26% on a constant currency basis, with the mobility business growing at record rates, getting to record levels, and delivery continuing to be strong as well. So as long as the consumer stays strong, I think Uber will continue to add on top of that the power of our platform, our being the number one brand in the business and our having the strongest tech team out there. It adds up to pretty good progress for us. And the indications that we gave going forward are of continued strength as 2023 is off to a really great start.
That said, Jay Powell said inflation is going to take a significant time to fight, no uncertain terms. What about when prices catch up with consumers? What are you, Dara Khosrowshahi, worried about when it comes to the bumpy parts of the road ahead?
Well, we saw prices increase last year for Uber pretty significantly, but we're seeing the price increases modulate pretty significantly as we get into 2023. Our surge levels are down. So in the U.S., for example, less than 20% of our trips are surging. Our ETAs are much faster now, faster than 5 minutes on average in the U.S. as well. So we have to keep working to improve our service. And when we look at inflation, about 70% of our drivers are saying that inflation is playing a factor in terms of their coming to earn money on the Uber platform. So in some ways, inflation may be a tailwind to our supply. Better supply means less surge and lower prices for us.
Now, Uber hasn't had widespread layoffs like some of your counterparts. I'm thinking DoorDash. At this point, would you promise that doesn't happen?
Well, running a company, you can make promises like that, right? We run the company based on our performance. As you've seen this quarter and what we indicated for quarters going forward, our performance has been really robust, and we think it will continue to be robust.
That was Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi. Let's continue the conversation. D.A. Davidson and co. Senior Research Analyst Tom White joins us with more. Tom, you got a buy rating, $62 price target. It was interesting to see the upside on the bottom line, you know, a nice EBITDA beat. But they also talked about how they're kind of doing less on the incentive side for drivers. Are they getting the mix right now, or is this just about improving macro conditions?
Yeah. First off, thanks for having me. Yeah, you know, look, the quarter was really nice. Solid upside on both the top and bottom line, and specifically in both the mobility segment and the delivery segment. The first quarter guidance was also very strong and positive. You know, particularly on EBITDA. This, you know, if they put up the number in the first quarter that we think they can, you know, it'll be the seventh straight quarter where Uber has been able to show sequential improvement in EBITDA dollars. And, you know, I think that's really kind of the super high level takeaway from the quarter is that these guys are really executing on revenues and monetization, but particularly on kind of costs and efficiencies. You know, so much so that they also gave the street, you know, a new kind of profitability milestone or objective to focus on this year, which is GAAP operating profit. You know, that's after depreciation and amortization, after stock-based comp. So, you know, a real sort of high quality profit metric, you know, relative to what they've shown so far, you know, in terms of positive EBITDA.
Oh, Tom, for so many years, we got hung up on EBITDA when it came to Uber and Lyft. You're saying now, forget about it. We're back to GAAP. Interesting. Khosrowshahi is saying the company taking market share. Do you believe him?
Yeah, look, it would appear that that's what's happening in mobility and maybe even in delivery, too. You know, I think the mobility business grew something like 37% FX neutral in the quarter. You know, we'll see what Lyft puts up in terms of their growth rate when they report here shortly. But, you know, we're forecasting, I think, something close to 20% growth in Lyft's business. Obviously, it's a little bit apples to oranges because Uber's got an international presence in mobility. But it would appear that, you know, they are gaining some category share in mobility. And then on the delivery side, again, you know, Uber's geographically kind of far flung in terms of its delivery business. But, you know, that accelerated, the year-over-year growth rate accelerated in the fourth quarter, up about 100 basis points to 14% growth. You know, all the underlying KPIs for that business were strong, too. So it looks like they're probably taking a category share kind of in both of those segments.
Talk to us about your price target, because it is 62. That's well off where we are today, but it is actually where basically the price topped out at back in 2021. What takes us there? Is it the here, the now, the macro, the reality? Or do we have to go back to the big sky thinking, the autonomous vehicles and the like?
Yeah, look, it's a little bit of both, not to cop out on the question there. But, you know, when we look at Uber, what we see is a large local commerce online marketplace business that has established, you know, clear category leadership in the mobility product and that core mobility product, and, you know, on its way to, you know, a long-term kind of competitive strength in delivery as well. And you know, generally speaking, online marketplace businesses, once they achieve scale and hopefully category leadership, you know, they can be highly profitable businesses, you know, EBITDA margins, you know, well into the teens and potentially higher. So, you know, the $62 target, I think, gives them, you know, maybe a little bit advanced credit on kind of on getting there. But on a revenue multiple, you know, it's only 3.5 times next year's, this year's revenues, I should say, you know, not horribly aggressive, we don't think.
Bring us back to reality of regulatory issues, too. How much of a concern are they? How much is there an overhang for this year?
Yeah, look, it's always a concern. You know, I think generally speaking, you know, the risk is that, you know, that it's going to increase costs borne by Uber, and therefore Uber's going to have to get more and more creative about how it passes those costs on to consumers in the form of higher prices. So far, when we look at markets or cities where there's been higher costs or sort of a regulatory burden that's resulted in higher fees or surcharges, we haven't really seen much of a detectable negative impact on the business. You know, that won't last for, you know, that won't last forever if the fees kind of continue to go up or the consumer starts to feel a pinch. But, you know, so far, so good on that front. You know, I'd say one thing, I think mitigating the upward pressure on costs from some of these higher kind of regulatory burdens is just what's happening in the labor market and the fact that, you know, there are more people out there looking for gig work and that's, you know, they're coming to places like Uber and Lyft to find earnings opportunities.
Tom White, great to have some time with you. D.A. Davidson & Co., Senior Research Analyst. Thanks for your time. Meanwhile, coming up, we're going to be talking about regulatory overhang elsewhere, a major setback for Microsoft's $69 billion takeover of Activision Blizzard. We discussed the hurdles it currently is facing in the UK. Ed, you're going to look at a key company as well on the move.
Yeah, I'm looking at Sonos shares in after hours, up 15%. Reiterating its fiscal 23 outlook, a beat on the top line, a beat on the bottom line. Interesting given how much competition there is in this space from the likes of Amazon through to Apple and Samsung now moving into home audio equipment and kind of these docking stations as well. But good performance in the quarter just gone, which is their fiscal first. Shares up 15%. This is Bloomberg.
What if everyone at work were an expert communicator? What if every doc, message, and email they wrote was perfectly clear and concise? Inbox numbers would drop, customer satisfaction scores would rise, and everyone would be more productive. That's where Grammarly comes in. Grammarly is a secure AI writing partner that understands your business and can transform it through better communication. Companies that use Grammarly save an average of 19 days per employee per year. That's because with Grammarly's AI, what used to take a few hours only takes a few clicks. Like generating an instant first draft in your company voice or tailoring a message to your specific audience and goals. And Grammarly's personalized on-brand writing help is built in everywhere your team works, across 500,000 apps and websites. Plus, it's safe, secure, and already IT approved. Join 70,000 teams who trust Grammarly with their words and their data. Learn more at Grammarly.com. Grammarly, easier said, done.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. Those with the ambitious, out-of-reach ideas, begging to become real solutions. They share a vision for how our world and our lives can thrive when bold thinking meets strong silicon. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy through the power of supercomputing. They dream of trust and privacy for all, of advancing and expanding education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to build something better, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
I want to bring you another Bloomberg scoop from earlier. One of the world's largest cryptocurrency exchanges, Kraken, is embroiled in a probe by the SEC over whether it broke securities rules related to certain offerings to clients. The probe is in advanced stages with announcements expected as soon as this week, according to sources. Any action against Kraken could have significant ramifications for the industry, Caroline.
Talking of ramifications, there are some big ones when it comes to a big deal, Ed. Microsoft's $69 billion takeover of Activision Blizzard is hanging in the balance, all because of UK regulators. They're challenging the proposed deal. Shares of Activision have actually been falling as much as 4% after the news was announced. Let's dig into the detail. Cecilia D'Anastasio is here with us in the studio when we thank her hugely for it. Cecilia, what's the UK hung up on here more than others?
The UK is hung up on the idea that allowing Microsoft to acquire Activision Blizzard would harm competition, particularly of competitors like Sony, who compete with Activision Blizzard in the console market.
To that end, are we seeing the fact that they are talking more directly about selling off certain labels? Call of Duty, everyone thinks that they would be forced to sell. Would they, do you think? Is that going to be a rallying cry from other regulators?
One of the potential remedies that the CMA shared today was the idea that Activision Blizzard would divest from Call of Duty, which is its blockbuster video game. It brought in $1 billion, the latest installation in October, within 10 days of its release, and buoyed Activision Blizzard during a really tough earnings season for a lot of gaming companies. So it's safe to say that Activision Blizzard is not happy about that suggestion at all.
Cecilia, nice to see you. Busy morning for you and I. We've both seen that memo from CEO Bobby Kotick, right? And what's so interesting is he's clearly trying to normalize this as being just another step in an M&A process. That's a pretty consistent message from him. The other thing that jumped out at me is him talking about competition from the likes of Apple and Facebook, not other publishers. Why do you think that is?
It's really tough. I mean, gaming companies were for a long time considered their own segment away from tech companies broadly. But over the last decade, gaming companies and tech companies have more and more in common as they expand their businesses into IP, into advertising, into all sorts of areas traditionally associated with companies like Apple and Facebook. Even social media, people socialize over video games in some cases just as much as they do over Instagram, Snapchat, etc.
We've just come out of a busy week of earnings in the video game industry, not just here in the US, but over in Japan with Sony as well. Activision was actually a bright spot. How did they perform?
Activision performed all right. Like I said before, Call of Duty really buoyed Activision's revenue last quarter because the last installment of the game really broke records, selling $1 billion within 10 days of its release. And Activision had a 43% jump in bookings, partially as a result of that, during a time that's been really tough for a lot of other gaming companies.
So, Cecilia, as we ask you to work a little later to come on the show with us, just talk to us about where next for this show, where next for this storyline. Are we waiting for other regulators to pile on? Are we waiting for the U.S.?
Yeah, the U.S. Federal Trade Commission did also sue to block the deal. So there are a lot of roadblocks in sight for Activision Blizzard going forward. So the CMA is scheduled to issue a final ruling in April, and Microsoft can then actually appeal that decision. But the deal was scheduled to close in June. So it's possible that, and maybe even likely at this point, that their deadline will get extended.
Bloomberg, Cecilia D'Anastasio, thank you so much for joining us for the latest reporting. Let's get more on this story of John Freeman of CFRA. CFRA maintains a hold rating on the shares of Activision with a 12-month price target, $83 a share. John, you heard me talking to Cecilia about Bobby Kotick trying to normalize this, telling his staff this is just another step in the M&A timeline, the procedure. Why then did shares fall?
Because I think that's a really great way to put it. He tried to normalize it, right? But this is not a normal situation. I mean, I covered a lot of tech, and there's been a lot of regulatory, you know, opposition to things that I thought were over the top or unnecessary. This one's a pretty good argument, though. Microsoft does have a monopolistic position, a duopoly, you know, with Sony, so that you can argue that they have a monopolistic position. And they're, by their own justification, they want to use a third party that rests on that platform. That's why they're buying Activision. So you're not allowed to use a platform or a monopolistic position in a platform to unfairly compete against others, you know, that are third parties on that platform, or to use it against other platforms unfairly. Right. So that's the crux of it. And I think that's a pretty good argument right now.
John, I appreciate you are not a merger arbitrage specialist per se, but there is a premium, right, for your price target above where we're trading. Does any of this change your view on the likelihood of the deal?
No, I think I've never seen such a large spread. Well, I mean, it does influence me.
That's my point.
I think that it's a signal that says the deal might not go through. Because I've never seen a spread like this, an acquisition that's this large. You know, the share price offer was $95 a share, and it's been trading. That it's trading now in the low 70s. So obviously, there's a lot of, you know, if you go by the wisdom of crowds, right? Then, you know, there's obviously a lot of people who are betting against this deal getting done.
It was interesting talking about just how expensive it would be if this deal did fall apart. It's notable that they get a nice cash injection if it did all fall apart. But really, Bobby Kotick clearly wants it to go through. He sees this as the right direction for his company.
He does, and I think he and very much so. But I'm not sure he's going to get there. You know, I think that if there is, you know, the concession of selling off Call of Duty, then I think it's a non-starter, because Call of Duty is why Microsoft is buying it. They look at it as kind of a real proto-metaverse kind of you know, a way to build on the metaverse, just the technology, but also the users and so forth. And obviously, it's you know, an incredibly profitable and popular title. You know, the results speak for themselves. In the last quarter, you know, EA and Take-Two struggled, while Call of Duty, you know, did really well. But, you know, so I think that, but for Microsoft to understand, like, their payment of $3 billion would be nothing for them. I mean, they have over $100 billion, right, in gross cash. So, you know, but it would be significant for Activision. So I think it's not a bad consolation prize, as Activision goes.
John, joy having you. One of the best backdrops. Phil, we're in a world of academia with you. Thank you. John Freeman, a CFRA. Stay well. LeBron James. He's got a lot of titles, and now he has a new one. All-time leading scorer in the NBA. Last night, the Lakers star surpassed the mark of 38,387 points that was held by Kareem Abdul-Jabbar. Now, James has another impressive accomplishment apart from this. According to Bloomberg Billionaires Index, he's worth about $1.1 billion. Now, that's due to his basketball earnings, plus sponsorships, investments, his own consumer and entertainment business. Ed, it's called Spring Hill. But King James, he's really been reeling it in, not only in some of the congratulations that have come from, what, the likes of Rihanna, but also the fact that he managed to manage his money, not just in ETFs.
Yeah, and it's a game recognizes game moment. Our beloved Warriors, Golden State Warriors here, acknowledging that success. It's good for the LA Lakers as well, because when Jabbar broke the record in 1984, he was playing for the Lakers as well. It's a double victory, but he's a king on the court and a king off it in terms of his business. And also startup empire is a really keen, I suppose, venture capital investor.
Yeah, if you look at it, Spring Hill Company, what is it now? About more than $780 million is where it's valued at. He set that up with Maverick Carter. It's a video production company. I forgot that, of course, he made a load of money in Beats as well, that sold out to Apple at such an amazing amount.
Yeah, and also just the brand image, right? You see him everywhere. And this, frankly, is what everyone's been talking about on Twitter, TikTok, and been searching for on Google. No surprise, it's going viral.
Well, meanwhile, that does it for this edition of Bloomberg Technology. Come back tomorrow. We're going to be breaking down so many earnings for you, from Lyft to PayPal, Expedia. Ed.
And don't forget, a lot to recap. Check out our podcast. You can get it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, iHeart, and of course, on the Bloomberg platforms. A lot for you to catch up on. This is Bloomberg.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
You know, it can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. Invisible struggles like stress and burnout, caregiving for a loved one, or being misunderstood. But insight, awareness, and empathy will help us better see the issues they're dealing with. And that can make us and our companies healthier too.
I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.